TGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 374, recorded on January 10th, 2015.
Welcome to the 374th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 207th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
Hi, I'm Andrew Yoon.
I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes Gaming Flashback.
Yeah, I actually included a Gaming Flashback this time.
Aw, yeah.
And Andrew here is guest podcast hosting for this week. So
yeah, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Now, for those who don't know, were you a managing editor at Joystick?
Yeah. I was one of the senior editors there, and and then I moved to Shack News, where I was editor in chief.
Wow. Oh, I do Shack News a lot. You know, we have the news items there. You know, I forgot to check Shack News this week. But
nifty.
He also has a Kickstarter project going on, a card game called Divorce.
Yep, and it should be in retail stores next month. So pretty excited for that.
Oh, congratulations!
Yeah. Now, Paul, you might enjoy this because basically it's a really bitchy game in which you're trying to get the most money out of your divorce, taking the house, destroying property, that sort of thing, trying to please the kids, get them on your side.
And how does one do that?
So it's a card game. It's a physical card game. The deck represents all of your marital assets, so things like the house, the car, the wedding ring. These are all represented by cards, and you're just divvying up your assets in a way where you end up with more money than your ex. And along the way, you can get lawyers who obviously cost money and, you know, give you debt, but give you abilities to steal cards and generally mess around with one another.
Mm. Oh, nice.
It's a very hostile game, but in a good way. Anyway, so what have you been playing, Paul?
Infinity.
Disney Infinity, that's it?
Oh, yeah.
So how far have you gotten? You said you got in one world, right?
Yeah, I completed the Avengers playset, and now I am bouncing around looking for new content.
Yeah. And how about you, Andrew? Have you been playing anything aside from Divorce?
Yeah, so I actually just recently finished Infamous Second Son.
Oh, okay.
I've been sort of on an Infamous kick lately, so went through Infamous 2 and then did a Festival of Blood and finished...
Second Son, that's the PS4 title, right? It was a launch title.
Yeah. It's a near launch title. It came out a few months after the PS4 launch, but around like January or so. So about a year ago.
Because you know, the way they numbered the Infamous series is hard to tell. You know.
The fact that they abandoned the numbering system after 2.
Yeah, I'm glad Halo didn't do that. Well, sort of. I mean, they did do have Halo ODST, Halo Reach, but at least it was a prequel. As for me, I just started a new game. Yeah, so this was actually just wow, that's really loud there.
Yeah, sorry. I guess for the listeners that aren't exactly clear about where I am, I'm actually at a game jam right now, which is sort of wrapping up. We just finished. We're putting the finishing touches on our game. So
we have
the past
a real
24 hours.
You are there sort of feel to it. So game jam is that sort? Is that wait? Is that anything like Child's Play?
No.
You don't know what a game jam is?
Child's Play is a charity where you donate toys to game jams are generally their development challenges essentially. So think of it as like Iron Chef but for video games. So,
yeah, basically you make a video game in a weekend with a group of complete strangers.
Oh wait, I think I've heard of this.
Yeah, so we've been
I've only been talking about them for forever, Jonah.
Yeah, so we've been locked up for the past 24 hours working on our games, and I just recently cut our trailer, and it's pretty exciting. So it's a lot of fun.
Andrew, you may not know this, but Paul also works on the video games as
Paul's a video game designer, and Jonah constantly forgets that.
I say developer, and he corrects.
It's part of our shtick.
I say he's a developer, he corrects me, so. It's the way it goes. Disney used to work for Disney Interactive, and also Team USA Insanity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so I worked for the US Olympic team.
Yeah. Did you work on the Fairy MMO, the Disney Fairy MMO? Or
I did work on the Fairy MMO.
So anyway, now we're now in 2015, and the rule about gaming flashback is that we do games that are at least 10 years old. So, having gotten to 2015, we have a whole new bunch of games to look at. Now, I was thinking about doing Psychonauts, but instead, I'm doing.
But it's a long year, and it just started.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think this one has a little bit more impact. And I think it has more impact than people give it credit for being. So this week's gaming flashback is LEGO Star Wars, the video game. LEGO Star Wars, the video game, is a video game based in the Star Wars-themed toy line by the LEGO Group and the first by Traveler's Tales Games LEGO video game franchise. It's a video game adaptation based on the Star Wars prequel trilogy, which is The Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones, and Revenge of the Sith, with a bonus segment from the first Star Wars, A New Hope. LEGO Star Wars was first released on April 5th, 2005, a month before Revenge of the Sith premiered, which basically that was the hook, is that you get to play Revenge of the Sith before you actually see it. It was released for the Xbox, the PS2, and PC, with Griptonite Games developing the Nintendo Game Boy Advance version. Gameplay in LEGO Star Wars is geared towards family play, and as such does not feature a game over scenario. Given a specific set of characters in each scenario, based on a scene from each of the movies, players can control them using their different abilities. Walking up to another friendly character, the player can switch control over to that character, which is necessary for using some of their abilities to complete puzzles. Studs can be found by finding them, smashing, or using the force on certain objects, or defeating enemies. Players will lose studs, however, if their character is destroyed, as opposed to losing lives, which is basically how Sonic works. You know, studs instead of rings. These studs can be spent on unlocking new characters in the free play mode. Certain segments of the game feature players controlling spaceships flying on a flat plane. There are also several mini-kit canisters throughout each level that, when connected, can come together to form a vehicle. Completing certain requirements, such as collecting enough studs in a level, earns golden bricks that can be traded for cheats. When the player first starts the game, they must complete Chapter 1 of the Phantom Menace negotiations. However, once that chapter is completed, the player may choose to play levels from the other two movies, able to play any unlocked levels in their desired order. The LEGO Star Wars contains a total of 59 playable characters for LEGO Star Wars, 56 in the GameCube, PS2, Xbox, and PC versions. Characters are divided among groups according to certain skills. For example, the Jedi and Sith can double jump, use lightsabers, and have control of the Force, which they can use to activate or lift LEGO objects or defeat certain enemies. Darth Maul has a double-ended lightsaber, which improves his defense from laser fire. Jar Jar Binks, General Grievous, and his bodyguard have super jump, which allows obstacles that the Jedi and Sith can't jump to.
So they're trying to make Jar Jar less useless. Gotcha.
Characters like Padme and Amidala and clone troopers who carry blasters have the ability to grapple to reach higher places. Droids, while not being armed, can travel through the game without being intentionally attacked by any characters. Also, protocol droids and alphabet droids can open special doors. Unlocked characters can be imported into the game's sequel, LEGO Star Wars 2, the original trilogy, as an extra called Use Old Save, which costs 250,000 LEGO studs and can be used in its character creator function, which, by the way, you could mix the heads and bodies of various characters.
Oh, that sounds kind of cool.
LEGO Star Wars is credited with starting the LEGO game series and revitalizing the LEGO brand. IGN rated the game an 8 out of 10, saying if you're a parent, LEGO Star Wars, the video game, should be at the top of your child's birthday list. It has everything a family-oriented title needs. It has personality, puzzles, cooperative modes, replay value, low violence, a lack of frustrating difficulty, and most importantly, it has Darth Vader. And that's what makes it enjoyable for adults, too, because let's face it, Darth Vader makes everything better. It's a fact.
Well, that seems like an awfully biased review.
Well, all reviews are biased. What are you talking about?
That seems like an awfully biased review.
Now, the reason why I say LEGO Star Wars is important, not only did it start up an entire line of LEGO games, you know, which have just gotten bigger and bigger.
And which are still going strong, and I did not get LEGO Batman 3 for Christmas, I will have you know.
Is that a hint? And
not to you.
It also actually indirectly, or maybe directly, into the LEGO movie.
Yeah. I can see that.
And the other thing is that this game reintroduced family games. you know, Fantasy just had a sleep. But the other thing about this game is it had a really good sense of humor, especially with all the characters pantomiming. It was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I first started playing with the Lego Batman in the franchise, and it was, like, awesome because, hey, why not? And, they saved a ton of money on voice acting and just made it more charming.
Well, starting with Batman 2, they started talking. It didn't really take away from it.
Nah, I don't care for it.
Andrew?
I think for some franchises, it makes sense to have the voice acting. The pantomiming worked fine, but I think, some of the characters, you really do want to hear their voices. And especially given that they do really silly recreations of these scenes. I don't know. I like it both ways. I think Traveler's Tales does a great job with or without voice acting. I think they know what they're doing, you know?
I don't think anybody wanted to hear Jar Jar Binks talk anyway. So.
Good point.
So, yeah, that's this week's gaming flashback, and we're going to move on to game news.
So, wait. So, does that make this week's question of the week, what was your first LEGO game?
You know what? I didn't have a question of the week. That might as well. Well, have you played any of the LEGO games is a better question.
Have you played any of the LEGO games? Okay, better question. Yeah. Fine.
Anyways, if you want the game news, take it away, Paul.
Oh,
and by the way, this is an update to last week's news.
Scrolling.
DDoS.
DDoS service targeting PSN and Xbox powered by home internet routers. And this comes to us from Ars Technica. The miscreants taking credit for knocking image board site 8chan offline, and earlier for taking down Sony's and Microsoft's gaming networks, operates an attack platform powered mostly by thousands of hacked home internet routers, according to a published report. The revelation, in an article posted Friday by Krebs on Security, is the latest evidence documenting a big uptick in the hacking of internet routers. Over the past 18 months, researchers have uncovered several other large-scale attacks in routing devices, including those made by
Asus,
Linksys, and many other manufacturers. Routers are often ripe targets because users fail to change default passwords, and the devices can contain security variables that can easily be exploited by hackers halfway around the globe. Those compromising routers for financial gain appear to be members of the Lizard Squad, a group that operates on an online attack service that promises to take down any site a paying customer has requested. Krebs on Security namesake Brian Krebs cited security researchers assisting law enforcement officials investigating the group. The researchers asked to remain anonymous. According to Krebs, the for-hire denial of service is powered by a network of compromised devices that mostly include home routers from around the world that are protected by little more than default usernames and passwords. Krebs writes, quote, "The botnet is not made entirely of home routers. Some of the infected hosts appear to be commercial routers at universities and companies, and there are undoubtedly others involved. Once considered to be a novelty hack, a router compromises are moving into the mainstream, and for good reason. It's much harder to compromise Windows-based computers now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. For denial of service attack campaigns and some other online criminal ventures, router hacks work just as well and are much easier to carry out on a mass scale."
You know, that was news to me that these guys were actually mercenaries that people can pay to do these attacks on.
Yeah, that is news.
Yeah. But I think the overarching message of this is please change your password on your router.
Oh, yeah. I mean, having the same password on your computer and your luggage isn't a good idea, so...
What?
Come on, it was a space joke.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah. No. That's amazing. That's the same combination I have on my luggage.
Andrew?
No, I mean, it's completely true. It just the sad fact of the matter is most people don't know how to change passwords on their routers, right? Thankfully, things are a lot better now because most routers that are installed come with a default password that's no longer 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? They're much more complex alphanumeric strings.
Yeah, it's no longer...
Lots of annoying characters.
It's
yeah.
No longer admin password. That is the username and the password is admin password. I mean, mine has had a different password. The thing is, you also have to regularly change your password too. It isn't just having a unique password. You really have to change it every so often because at some point it'll get cracked for whatever reason.
Yep.
Anyways, we're gonna move on to the next news item. Take it away, Andrew.
All right. So apparently, Japanese console sales continue to slide in 2014. In terms of both software and hardware revenue combined, the Japanese console market was worth about 369 billion yen in 2014, which is down about 10% year on year. This information is coming from gamesindustry.biz. And apparently, the Japanese games market really has been affected by mobile, which is really what has steadily affected the amount of revenue that the industry is making over there. When you compare monetary values in specific currencies across such long periods of time, there's problems with conversion. But the trend is clear because hardware sales were at their lowest since Famitsu, the leading Japanese magazine over there, gaming magazine over there. It's been the lowest since they started recording hardware and software revenue in 1997. So, that's pretty irrefutable. Software revenue is also in decline. The top five best-selling games of the year, also more than 2 million units, and it's actually the first time that any five games have sold that well. And so games like Yokai Watch 2 Shin Uchi, which was actually only available for 16 days. So games that are incredibly successful become tremendously successful in Japan, while a lot of other games sort of fail. And in fact, every single one of these top five games was a Nintendo 3DS release. So while Nintendo dominated with two other games being on the Wii U. So Nintendo's really doing quite well in Japan, which seems to contrary to what people think here in the States. Most of the major releases for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One only arrived at the end of the year. And to be honest, especially with my friends in Japan, a lot of people haven't picked up the next-gen consoles, either PS4 or Xbox One, just because there isn't content that's interesting or geared to them quite yet,
Yeah.
I can relate.
Actually, according to Famitsu, it's even earlier. It was the lowest point since 1991, just before they started recording. One of the problems is that, video gaming has gone from being a niche hobby to something that's extremely mainstream.
To big business, quite frankly.
Yeah. And the problem is that, as technology has increased, it takes more and more money to make a game, and while large companies, the problem is that the population of Japan has remained the same. It's just that the rest of the population, there's more people who are buying video games, and therefore, budgets of some of the games can be astronomical. Just ask any, Call of Duty and stuff like that. With the assets costing so much, it makes a lot of sense that handhelds would be dominating in Japan, especially since Japan is a public transit sort of place. Sort of like New York, except more of the country. So it's like you have your handheld console, riding the train, playing it, doing your street pass and stuff like that. And it's, Nintendo even said a year ago that Apple was their main competitor, not Sony. They felt that, cell phones and cell phone games and tablets were more of a competition for Nintendo. And it looks like they're right.
I don't know. I kind of think that probably they've gone ahead and thrown a hat into the gauntlet of cross-media games as well. I mean, they've got their Amiga figures, so they're going to start competing. So they're starting to compete with Skylanders and Infinity, which on that front makes Disney one of their top competitors too. So it's like, yikes.
Well, that
interesting choice there.
That kind of makes Kingdom Hearts a little bit, a little bit edgy, doesn't it? Because if they're competing against each other, well, that's a collaboration between the two. What's interesting is that Kingdom Hearts is not being released for the Wii U.
I don't believe you.
It's, look it up. It's only being released for Xbox One and PlayStation 4. Those are the only two consoles it's listed for.
Well, then I'll have a reason to buy 3-year-old hardware.
Andrew?
I mean, in Kingdom Hearts, I mean, it makes sense that it's not going on Wii U. As much as I love the games on that console, its hardware is incredibly lacking. So, you know, it's being targeted for current gen systems, and Wii U isn't really up to spec. But I don't. I disagree with saying that Disney and Nintendo are competitors. I think I don't think Nintendo's amiibos are targeting the same audience that that Skylanders are. I think the amiibo definitely target Nintendo's hardcore audience. You know, their dedicated fan base, while Skylanders, you know, appeals to a much like broader base of children. So,
that is definitely
different. You know, different marketing.
That's a fair observation. But when it comes to, you know, the ageless quality of a Nintendo fan and a Disney fan, that kind of, you know, overlaps pretty much.
Well, I mean,
there as well. I mean, in the same way that like you either kind of grow out of Disney or you don't, and the same way you kind of grow out of Nintendo or you don't.
I don't know. It's sort of like RoboCop to me. It's sort of like, can I have you both? You know, I mean, you could.
Yeah, yeah.
And buy both figurines, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But what I think is even more interesting to me is that this kind of represents an entire new field of, you know, an entire new genre of gaming. The, you know, the cross-media games, if you will, in the same way that, like, Rock Band appeared out of nowhere, and overnight everybody had a plastic guitar in their house.
Andrew?
Yeah.
No, I mean, so Activision's been really smart. I mean, I'm not sure if you guys know the story behind Skylanders, but do you know who actually makes the Skylanders?
Oh, good. Please, I would love some enlightenment.
Okay, so the Skylander figurines are actually manufactured by the company that was formerly known as Red Octane, that used to make Guitar Hero guitars. And so as Activision noticed that it would sunset the Guitar Hero brand and wouldn't be able to successfully monetize plastic instruments anymore, they had that unit start making plastic toys. So you have they made this really smart pivot where once they milked all the money out of the Guitar Hero franchise, the Skylanders franchise was waiting in the wings. And so Activision is just a really smart company in that they can sort of foresee consumer trends and really just maximize their margins, because plastic toys, they make a lot of money. Consumers are willing to spend, you know, $12+ on these figurines, and the margins are really spectacular. So
and I think
it's really, yeah.
That kind of also speaks to a more Eastern philosophy when it comes to manufacturing practices. I mean, we're here in America, our domestic automobile factories can each only make one thing, and all of the machinery is bolted down to the ground because, you know, to us, this is the Hummer factory, and it's only ever going to make Hummers, because why would anybody want anything other than a Hummer? Which, by the way, I'm not even sure they sell anymore after.
They discontinued that a while ago, yes.
Well, I mean, so now the Hummer factory is just sitting there in Detroit gathering dust, whereas Japan manufacturing didn't really have this philosophy. You know, within a day, they could have, you know, because their machinery is all kept fairly mobile, if they decided to stop selling, you know, Toyota Accords, they could move move their machine around in about 24 hours. And
I just want to point out that Activision's an American company. So,
right.
And all this manufacturing happens in China. So, you know,
yes,
both Amiibos and Skylanders.
Suicide. Yes, we know.
Yeah.
Right. I'm using Japan as an example of an Eastern manufacturing methodology, and I was about to tie it back to the tangent of the shift that Activision made from going from large scale plastic, you know, upscale pieces to these tinier ones.
You know, what the next step is? They're going to have to make, once they make those things posable, look out.
Absolutely.
If you're having posable figurines, then, you know, people are just going to go nuts.
Oh my God, points of articulation? People would junk all of the
You sell the same characters again to people. Like, they throw away their old Thor and Captain America and get the ones that you could play with, especially for your kids. If they could shrink the RFID chip down into the feet so that they didn't have to stand on a base, that'd be awesome.
Andrew, were you at E3 like 3 years ago when they first introduced the Skylanders? Remember how they introduced them? They had this fog and all that, and these large characters came out of the ground at Activision's booth, and it was like, dun dun dun. And I was thinking, what the heck is this?
I forget when exactly I first saw Skylanders, but I do remember thinking, like, oh my god, Activision's gonna make so much money. that was really the first reaction that I had.
And they started an entirely new... You see, keep in mind, Skylanders and Infinity and Amiibo, that was the holy grail. People have, for years, for the past 10, 15 years, have been trying to merge video games and toys. You know, they finally got to that point, you know, in which they successfully did it. And now they have to think of, well, how can we increase it even more? And you know what? I said, you know, I should have said it. I should have sold my idea. Hey, listen, make them posable. You know, unfortunately, I'm going to lose millions of dollars because I said it on the podcast. They're going to listen. You know, they're going to use my idea without paying. So, anyway, thanks for making myself poor. We're going to move on to the next item. Evolve's questionable bargain, pre-purchase to avoid unlock grind. And this comes from some CVG, which is Computer Video Games. The team behind Evolve announced today that the Xbox One players who pre-purchased the game will have instant access to an entire tier of hunters, Parnell, Abe, Terra, and K-Bot, as well as the third revealed monster, the Wraith. If you don't pre-purchase the game, you can unlock all these characters by gaining experience with the role play. This instant access will apply both to Xbox One exclusive open beta next week and to the full release of the game next month. Evolve, which is out on February 10th on PS4, Xbox One, and PC, is an online game where four players team up to take on a fifth player who controls a giant monster. Each of the hunters are specialists in different ways of stopping or damaging the creature. For example, the Trapper class can lay down some dome shields to keep the monster from escaping to the other side of the map. To qualify, the player must place a pre-order on the digital version of the Xbox One game before or during the beta. And there's been a lot of people up in arms about this because it's basically, oh, well, if you want to pre-order, you can cheat, you know. Now, from what I understand, there isn't going to be any tactical advantage, you know. It's going to all be play balanced. But there are a lot of people who are fighting dangerous precedent. Andrew?
I mean, this tactic, I know, has a lot of people angry because I think, you know, based on previews of the game, it'll take about maybe 12 plus hours to get to the point in the game where you can unlock that content if you didn't pre-order it.
Now, by the way, it's the third tier being unlocked. You have two tiers, and I think the second tier is unlocked. I'm not sure, but either that or it's easily unlocked. So the second tier is like nothing. It's like the third tier. It's sort of like getting prestige class in Call of Duty.
But yeah, so you know, people are obviously a little upset about it. I'm personally, I don't know. I think 12 hours in an online multiplayer game will go by really quickly. And we live in a society where microtransactions in online multiplayer games is really common. So I think this is just what it is. You know, it's you're not paying for preferential. You know, XP boosts or you know, being able to cut through some of the grinding, but that's how online XP systems are designed nowadays, and I think we're just going to see more of this kind of stuff in the future.
Paul?
I think it's an interesting experiment as far as trying to figure out new business model methodologies. You know, would somebody rather go through the effort of paying a little bit more upfront or going through the trouble of pre-ordering if they didn't have to do as much grinding? Some players absolutely will. I know that I would probably have slightly more fun if I could, you know, pay Nintendo $5 to bypass leveling in the early Final Fantasy games. So I don't know. It just seems like a really interesting experiment, and I'd kind of be interested to see how it turns out.
You know, one thing that I think some people are upset about, it's sort of brushed over, but the fact that you have to buy the digital version, And remember, you really can't trade in digital versions. I know Steam has a program, but you really can't trade in digital versions. You can't trade it with your friends. You can't, you know, it's not a disc version. So in order to get that boost, you have to buy the digital version. And I think that's something that people are also a little bit upset about as well.
Yeah, but I mean, the industry's trying to educate consumers, incentivize consumers to take on this new behavior because it benefits the game making companies. And since people don't want to pay for games anymore because of, you know, the advent of free to play, I mean, like, what else is a game company supposed to do? We got to find ways to save money. And so to do that, we got to teach the public that it benefits everybody to download the game.
Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, it's digital is happening, and I don't know. I guess for me, like I've been waiting for an all digital ecosystem for quite some time. So yeah, you know, it sucks that you can't trade in your games, but like that's, I mean, if you want to be a day one adopter, like you pay a premium for that, and the premiums are, yeah, having buggy games, having to go through you know, exclusive pre-order bonuses and all this other stuff. You know, if you're really angry about all this stuff, just stop buying games on day one, wait a few weeks, and games drop down to like $30. Like, you know,
I think you just made Paul very happy because he has a thing about day one patches.
First of all, I can't, just because we haven't done a show together before, I think I should key you in on a few of my, you know, personal viewpoints. Number one, I can't stand day one patches. Number two, I won't pay retail for a video game that I don't think is worth it.
So, we're gonna.
And so those two things often coincide.
Totally. Especially more and more this generation. I mean, 2014 was a terrible year for having actually playable games available at launch, right? I mean, you still can't play the Halo Master Chief Collection.
Oh, jeez, really?
Well, you can play single player. It's the multiplayer that's happening.
You can play, yeah, but for a great majority of people, that's,
I mean, Halo's not exactly,
you play.
Yeah, I mean, like, Halo's not exactly my thing, but even I know that's, like, kind of the big draw there is to go and pwn some random internet stranger.
Well, I mean, people are having a lot of fun on the Halo 5 beta. You know, that's the main thing for them, really. I mean, playing Halo 2, the old Halo 2 multiplayer, it's a nice thing, but, you know, everybody's just getting jacked up for what's next, you know. So it's sort of like the Halo collection multiplayer sort of like appetizer.
Oh, you mean it's like a random Kingdom Hearts midquel while everyone's just waiting for Kingdom Hearts 3 15 years later?
Yeah, that's, by the way, Andrew, that's another thing that Paul's bitter about, is that he's still waiting for a new Kingdom Hearts story. He's tired of all these
I want an official number 3. I don't want, like, handheld half a game.
I mean, they certainly took a long time to get there, and as a Square Enix fan myself, it is incredibly frustrating, to say the least.
Oh, yeah, especially since, I mean, Square Enix has a long history of making fantastic RPGs, and it's just like, how many resources do you as a company have tied up in this one title? What other game are you backlogging because there's a problem on this one?
I think, yeah, I mean, just, you know, Final Fantasy XIII was just a huge disaster for that company, and
There's a lot of people looking at Final Fantasy XV and just looking at it like, okay, this is your last chance, Square. You better do this one right.
Yeah, frankly, I just want them to go back to doing, like, single-player Final Fantasies. Like, get out of the MMO market. MMOs are dead.
Well, I mean,
they're not new anymore. They're not interesting or innovative. Just, you don't do it well, so just Square Enix, get out of that market.
I mean, Square Enix makes money off of Final Fantasy XIV, and I know tons of people that really enjoy 14, especially after the reboot. So, you know, it's hard for me to, you know, agree with that assessment.
But do they enjoy 14 because it's a uniquely innovative MMO, or do they enjoy Final Fantasy 14 because it's part of Final Fantasy?
I mean, I don't think games need to be innovative per se. I think, you know, so long as a fan base is enjoying that product, I don't see why innovation is necessarily a requirement, you know?
Then you end up with 12 Clash of Clans clones.
As you say, I'm staring at my copy of Tabula Rasa for something different than orcs and elves, you know. The thing is that, you know, it's like they killed a perfectly healthy MMO. I'm sorry, that's my little gripe. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. We're all allowed to have a few sore spots, Jonah. We'll just not poke at yours.
Oh, stop it. The thing about Evolve is that I still can't believe it's coming on February 10th because everybody I speak to say it's still imbalanced. And for their game that's going to be 4-on-1, that's sort of an important thing, to have a game that's fully balanced, you know? It's not like Left 4 Dead in which you're fighting against the computer.
But, you know, especially when it comes to like weapon balance and experience balance and all that kind of stuff, I mean, those are numbers in a data sheet. Those can be changed fantastically fast.
Well, I don't think it's even numbers. It's like people have found exploits for the monster, you know, and the monster can do certain things, especially the Wraith, that makes it extremely difficult for the players to win, you know?
That makes it easy for the monster to win?
Yeah, the monster usually wins. I mean, the monster is played by a fifth player.
Right.
It's four people.
But the exploits are on the monster that make it easier for the monster to win.
Yeah, it's incredibly.
I'm a fan. I mean,
go ahead, Roger.
Obviously.
So, I'm sorry. Based on what I've played, the players have generally won. But I think the thing about the monster is that it does have a very steep learning curve, and I think it's really hard to really determine how balanced it is until it goes to a much larger audience of people. It's just hard to. It's difficult to balance a game like that just because there's so many systems to learn, and it can be really quite overwhelming. And it's a very different kind of game. So,
yeah.
I think it's just one of those things where they can't keep on pushing it. And as you pointed out, you can always change numbers on the fly really quickly. So, you know, it's the kind of thing where so long as Turtle Rock is responsive to community feedback, I think, it's not necessarily a problem that it's quote-unquote not balanced right now, you know?
I mean, especially someone who knows how to balance a video game, you know, they could probably go in on a local copy and test as many changes as they need to and get that whole thing rebalanced within a day.
But it's
of
true.
Normal
it,
working
I
time.
Mean, it still is tricky not to make it seem too obvious, like, you know, just we're going to remove this feature because it's imbalancing everything. You know, sometimes people don't want to feel, quote unquote, cheated. I mean, you can read all the complaints every time World of Warcraft makes a change. Everybody says that their class has been gimped or changed or something's wrong with it, you know. I mean, that's sort of like you have to be careful of not having that this as well.
Well, I think that when they talk about having it feel gimped, as it were, a word that I don't particularly care for, it's basically compared to what was overpromised in the first place. I mean, would Peter Molyneux have a reputation of not finishing things if he didn't promise 10 times as much as he delivered? Or would he be heralded as a, you know, even more of a genius if he only promised exactly what he was what he ended up delivering?
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. I mean, the thing about players that complain about, or just players that complain, period, is that players will complain about everything, period. And I think it's true that oftentimes the most vocal people on the internet don't necessarily represent
the majority
of people. So you know, whenever, I mean, think about the people that, you know, like the Call of Duty fans that make death threats to developers because of minute changes made to multiplayer, you know?
Well, you have to balance it out. I mean, you also have vocal players who are vocal because they're really into the game and they want to see the best product possible. I mean, it's just a matter of filtering out what feedback is useful and what feedback is not useful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, we're going to move on to the next item. I believe this is...
Sony delays PS4 in China, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. According to a statement issued to Reuters today, the delay is... Oh, sorry.
No, that's the second.
I yeah.
Sony has delayed the release of the PlayStation 4 in China from its initial launch date of January 11th, 2015. According to a statement issued to Reuters today, the delay is attributable to, quote, various factors, through a source within Sony indicated that negotiations for the, quote, Chinese authorities are a key factor. At present, Sony has not set a new date for the launch. While delays on important events such as this can be a cause for concern, there is an obvious precedent here. While the Xbox One is launched in China in September last year, Microsoft was also forced to delay just for a few days before its intended release date. In that case, the official explanation was similarly nebulous, but it stands to reason that there would be a significant logistical and bureaucratic procedures involved in launching a new console in a market like China. When it does hit the market, and the Xbox One delay was only a matter of days, the PS4 will be priced at about $485.
US. Now, I take that delay to be they're greasing some palms here. I mean, that's what I take away from it. Just, you know, give us some money under the table, and okay, we can go through. But this is very big because, you know, China obviously has over 1 billion people in it, and it's a huge market.
I mean, it is like 1/6 of the world's population.
Yeah.
But remember, a very small percentage of that population is middle class or, you know, or above. So it is still a communist nation, and, you know, wealth income disparity is quite high in China. But that being said, it is still a large market. But it's not a market that's particularly interested in consoles, so it'll be interesting to see how Xbox One and PlayStation 4 fare, given that it's a space that's dominated by PC games, largely because of China's history with console games. Consoles were, for the most part, banned in China until this generation, pretty much.
Or shamelessly copied, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly. So there were a few, like, unique attempts, the IQ by Nintendo, which was a collaboration with a Chinese company, but to be honest, a lot of companies weren't interested in entering the Chinese market because of high piracy rates, and once again, they didn't have that much disposable income. Obviously, the economy has changed quite significantly, and so has the government, which is why it's interesting to see PS4 and Xbox One entering the Chinese market. It's only a good thing, but, you know, a delay, it's not really that significant of a story.
The thing is that, the problem is it's a slow news week, so, because we're right after Christmas, the holidays.
Yeah, people are just cleaning out their inboxes.
Yeah.
But the thing is that companies are always looking for the next hot territory, you know? They're always looking for to find mine new riches in different places. And yep. China is basically the last frontier, really. I mean,
No. I mean, South America is a huge... Latin America as a whole is a really huge growth sector for video games.
But Latin America is now getting, you know, last-gen consoles. They're getting the PS3. Not even getting... They just opened up for the PS2 like 3 years ago or something like that, you know?
Well, it depends on which territories within Latin America, but the console, once again, consoles aren't necessarily the preferred way of playing games in those territories. You know, PC is incredibly healthy and strong in Latin America, but console is doing pretty well as well.
What was the name of that console? The Zeebo that was released in South America, something like that. I think it was actually a streaming console too, which is weird. Anyways, we're going to move on to listener feedback from Alpha Shard at Cultural Diversity in Games. I don't know which is sadder, that you both didn't think of Quest for Glory or The Witcher 3 when asking how many games at Baba Yaga. See, Paul, you should know this more than me because you're the Slavic one. Quest for Glory series explored not just European culture, but Arabian, Quest for Glory 2, and African, Quest for Glory 3 as well. You get to deal with Baba Yaga as a villain three times, once in Quest for Glory 1, and again, once again, in Quest for Glory 4, Slavic, which you also faced. Don't fall. Glory and Pursuit, along with the Vampires and Vampires, and finally in Quest of Glory 5, Echo Woman. I do thank Sirigi for showing me such diversity and cultural backgrounds in their games. They also had a series called The Incans. Now, the Witch has these hags, which seem to be the kind of creature that Baba Yaga is. If you see, they should have had. They should have had one of these ladies.
I can't hear a word you're saying.
That would have been a great nightmare. I do agree we need more game diversity of cultural backgrounds, and Sierra had a lot of that. Speaking of which, Ken Williams getting the New King's Quest game being made by the Odd Gentleman. At one point in the interview, Ken says how he doesn't like to categorize a game as that they should be more an experience and not get stuck on trying to be the next big thing. It made me think about how they tried to keep up with the change in the mark back in the 90s, struggles with motion video and then 3D games. Both this King's Quest and the Gabriel Knight 1 are corporate backed, while Kickstarted, Hero U, and Space Venture are not, and seem to be having trouble getting done at all. Yeah, I mean, I didn't play many of the Sierra games. I only played at least Larry, the original one.
I was kind of young when those were out. Got to be honest.
But you know what? I found out that I must have been one of the three or four people who actually bought Leisure Suit Larry and the Land of the Lounge Lizards. The rest of the 50,000 pirated it or something. At selling out. I like saying, if you can do something well, get paid for it. I think it makes sense. Everyone deserves to eat, even brilliant artists. I almost said everyone deserves to eat brilliant artists. That would have sounded bad. I mean, if you can make money for what you do, feel free. At Hacker Punks, I cannot wait for these punks to be arrested. They committed a crime, so yes, they will be investigated. I had to laugh at the phrase, quote, all the good hackers have done. Yeah, like what? Also, apparently Sony was, quote unquote, asking for it by not having better security. Now I wish Sony had worked harder on being more secure. It still doesn't give the right for them to break in. At playing online. I agree I don't like trying to play with random strangers and having a group of friends is great. So speaking of Polycast, we're always open to you dropping by on Saturday, Jono. We've been playing Civilization V and Beyond Earth lately. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, sometimes I play the game, the Polycast, which they're doing Civilization V. We play, they record what we're talking about, and then they just post it, you know. So it's that sort of weird thing. At the Christmas loot, I got a bag of holding from ThinkGeek, lightsaber chopsticks, a Star Trek communicator badge, a Professor Layton game, and a Doctor Who pocket watch. So I got some good geeky loot this Christmas. So that he was saying what you get for the holiday season. So, Andrew, what did you get for the holiday season? Since you never got to answer that question.
Let's see. What did I get? I got a ton of board games, but I can't remember their names off the top of my head, and I'm not really next to them. But yeah, I got way too many board games, which I'm okay with. I'm really excited to playing as many of them as I can. So really looking forward to that.
Mm. Yeah, all my gifts were money, so I just had to buy my.
I got Infinity.
Yes, we know, Paul. You went on about that for several hours. Yes.
I got Infinity.
Okay. Let's take the next one. Now that you highlighted it.
Sorry. Okay, so this is from Arthur V.
Arthur the Fifth, yay!
Or Arthur the Fifth.
Either one.
That could also. Help me, Mom. They hacked my Xbox. I wasn't affected this time around because I was with my family for New Year and mostly played offline. I will have to agree, though. Microsoft and Sony get hacked so often now that it's not even news anymore. I find it ironic how a snot can spit down on a huge company whenever he or he pleases. Something has to change. And it's true that these networks are getting hacked all the time. They're easy targets because the audience that they serve is so vocal and affected by it. So it's just they're just good targets, essentially.
Ken Levine said on Twitter, he said he can't wait until these hackers start World War III just for the lulls.
Yeah, and I just want to point out that I don't think Microsoft or Sony got hacked recently. It was just DDoS OS attacks, which is not hacking. So, you know, it's I sort of want people to not use the terminology just haphazardly, but, you know, just because it's annoying that you couldn't access online services, but at least your data wasn't taken, you know? So keep that in mind. It's not great or ideal, but yeah, that's the kind of era we live in, and this isn't going to make anyone feel better, but it's not just PlayStation Network and Xbox Live that are getting constantly attacked. You know, obviously, Home Depot, Chase, a lot of financial institutions, Target, these are large companies are getting hacked on a everyday basis, and whether or not you hear about it is an entirely different situation. So,
you know, that reminds me, Eric Snowden said that the United States focuses too much on offensive cyber warfare and not enough defensive cyber warfare.
That probably makes sense. Continuing on, speaking on Stalker, Shadow of Censored, maybe the Ukrainian government did not want the tourist influx into their danger zone. The Stalker series did raise Chernobyl's profile considerably. Last thing they wanted was amateur treasure hunters crawling around the sarcophagus looking for artifacts. On the folklore cultures, there are quite a few different mystical entities that would make good game characters. In fact, there are many Russian games based on the Russian folklore, but they never make it out beyond the Iron Curtain. There's just not enough demand. The reason why is because Greek and Roman gods are so popular because everyone knows them. On the contrary, most Westerners can't even pronounce, and I'm this person's proving their point, Voyjanoi or Kikimore, which happen to be mystical creatures.
I didn't know the Iron Curtain was still up. Oh, well.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it does kind of... I guess you do kind of need a better phonetic translation of a lot of those names.
And finally, QOTW. Not as much as I would like to. I only play online with my friends, and currently we have a mismatch of gaming platforms. I've lots of consoles, but no PC. I used to play a lot on Xbox Live. I have my fondest memories playing Bad Company 2, Borderlands, and Left 4 Dead 2 till the latest hours of the night. But university fixed that. I had no time to play anything at all. Now I can't get back into any online gaming. I have a huge backlog of single-player games and no worthy multiplayer games to keep me interested. It's been a long time since something fresh came out. Maybe Evolve and Halo will fix that.
Yeah, welcome to adulthood, in which now you can afford all the games you want, but you never have any time to play them.
That's the big joke no one tells you except us.
Anyways, the question of the week was, have you played any of the Lego games? And if so, which one was your favorite? Paul, do you have a favorite Lego game?
I am going to run with Lego Batman 1.
Okay. And
I thought the fact that they couldn't talk in that one just made it more charming.
How about you, Andrew?
I've played a lot of them, like the Harry Potters and the Lord of the Rings and the Batmans, and even the Marvel Lego games. It's hard to pinpoint the favorite just because they are, after a while, they just all sort of feel the same, to be honest. And they're mostly games that I play with my little brother, just because, you know, he's 9, 10 years old, that's just more his jam. So, I remember the Wii U Lego game, Lego City Undercover. That was pretty good. I don't know if it's the best, but it's certainly the one that comes off the top of my mind right now.
Well, if it's
now.
The one that you remember, you know, that comes to the top of your mind, you might as well use that one. Yeah. And, you know, there's something to be said for same machine gameplay. I mean, yeah, online multiplayer, fine, but, you know, it's so much fun when you have a person right next to you playing with you, and there's, you know, face-to-face, you know, interaction. You know, the person's right actually next to you, and if they piss you off, you can actually punch them in the face, you know? So, you know, I missed, because I remember playing Mule, and everybody had to huddle around the keyboard because there were 4 players, 1 keyboard, you had your keys, go. You know? As for me...
Yeah, not for nothing, I remember that back in the old DOS game days, it was like, okay, you're the first player, so you're gonna have to use ASD, and you're player two, so you have to use L semicolon and apostrophe. Like what? That's awful.
Yeah. So,
I mean, try explaining that to a 6-year-old.
Look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and your gaming history articles. If you enjoy feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast and our forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum, or send your comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments.
Woohoo, iTunes comments.
So, it was nice having you for this episode, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. I definitely would love to join again.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Anyways, we'll see you guys as in the audience, not you two, but we'll see you next week.
Bye, Bonds.
Have a good one.